You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Prock, the presenter of the Prock Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. What I'm going to do is first go over and summarize what I was talking about on the last show, namely we had the testimony of the new Federal Reserve Chairman, Janet Yellen. She's required by law to testify in front of Congress, which she was doing, and she promised to continue the policies of Ben Bernanke. Now, I hear that, and I have mixed feelings, because it was Ben Bernanke's economic policies, along with the previous Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, namely they're easy or very accommodative, that's the technical jargon term for it, that caused the asset bubble in the real estate market that ultimately resulted in a crash. You see, the Federal Reserve really has a lot of the blame for the crash belongs at the feet of the Federal Reserve. Now, there's a lot of blame to go around. But I view the Federal Reserve as part of the government. Technically, they're not, but they are, because they're a creature of Congress by a law written by the bankers but passed by the Congress and signed by Woodrow Wilson in December of 1913. And the Federal Reserve has been in business starting in 1914. As a matter of fact, this is going to be its 100th year. Now, central banks have two primary missions, and this is their justification for being. Number one, by far, is to be a so-called lender of last resorts. In other words, to prevent bank runs. Where you have a loss of confidence in a bank, what happens is, in the past, depositors, and it still happens today, by the way, what happens is depositors, for example, I went to the bank today. And I had to make a withdrawal because I had some groceries to pay for, and I also had to I have a cell phone, so I had to renew that for another 60 days. So I went to the bank, asked for what my balance was, withdrew some cash, used the cash to pay for some groceries, not a lot of groceries, but some groceries, and then go to a Radio Shack and pay for an additional 60 days. Well, what happens if there's a run on that bank? The lines would be outside the store. And usually in the past it was a rumor, the bank is failing. They can't pay depositors. What if I went in today and they say, sorry, Mr. Prock, you're going to have to wait another 30 days before we can pay out of your checking account? I'm going to say, excuse me, that's my money. That's not your money. In effect, what I'm doing is providing money to the commercial bank that they loan out. Most of it they loan out. However, by law, they're required to have some reserves at the central bank or the Federal Reserve. And they're also are regulated and are routinely audited. You have bank auditors going in to make sure the bank is solvent. In other words, the value of their assets exceed their liabilities. Where one of their liabilities, their major liability, is checking accounts, and to a lesser extent, savings accounts, but primarily checking accounts. And what the bank does, it loans most of that money, not all of it, because some of it, depending on what the reserve requirements are, have to be held in reserves at the Fed, but the rest can be loaned out, and the bank loans out. It tries to make money. So its liabilities are short term. I could walk in today and take out all my money if I wanted to. I'm not going to do that because I use them mainly for my checking account. I use it as a source for cash, and I also use it to write really large checks. That's just my rent check. And today, more and more people are using bank drafts. They'll use the email to draft their checking accounts. For example, I have to pay my electric bill, I got to pay for my car, my insurance. Well, I'm like most people, what I do is do that online and I give the information to whoever I'm doing business with, and they will draft my bank account. And I give them an authorization to do that. And I give them a one-time authorization. Some people make it automatic. I don't like that feature. I've been burnt in the past on that. So it takes me a little time. I could have set it up automatic and not worry about it. And many people like to do that. I don't. I'm somewhat of a control freak. Not really, but I like to deliberately review how much money I'm spending. I know, for example, that today and tomorrow, probably today, sometime this evening, I'll pay some bills. I'm going to pay for my car payment, my lease payment, my electric bill that I don't even want to look at because I'm sure it's high because we've had a lot of cold weather, and I'm going to pay for my car insurance. And those are the three that I usually pay for every month. And now other people pay for not only those, but a lot of other things. I like to pay cash, so I go to the bank. I don't even use an ATM at all. Never used an ATM because when I go shopping, the bank is there. I have to stand in line. It's usually a minute or two at most. Today, I just wrote the withdrawal, asked for my balance, gave them it, got the cash, and then spent the money. But what the bank does, a commercial bank does, is it then takes those excess reserves that it has and it makes money by making loans. Now, they make money other ways. What they normally are doing are making loans that are of longer term than their liabilities, which are short term. Now, I'm not trying to give you it might sound like I'm giving you an economic lesson in money and banking or financial economics. No, I'm trying to give you just the basics. What has happened is the Federal Reserve has been, their primary mission is should a bank run into financial trouble, namely they have had bad loans. For example, let's say they invested in mortgage-backed securities and the value of those mortgage-backed securities really plummeted in 2007, 8, and 9. So now the liabilities of the bank, and the main one being checking accounts, for example, exceed the assets. Well, if that's the case, the bank is technically insolvent. Insolvent. And usually what happens is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation will come in and close the bank. Now, one of the problems is the Federal Reserve has another responsibility that I really don't think they should have, is the regulation of these banks and keeping track of the banks, because they really were asleep at the switch, because we had literally hundreds of banks, and I didn't have time to check the exact number. It's been a while since I've looked, but as a result of the financial crisis starting in 2008, in the fall of 2008, continuing in 2009, many banks, large, medium, and small, were closed. They were insolvent. Another way to say it, they were bad stewards of the money. They weren't good risk managers. So that historically has been one of the primary missions of any central bank, including the Federal Reserve, is to act as a lender of last resorts to prevent runs on banks that are still solvent. In other words, where their assets, I'm simplifying here, where their assets, the total value of all their assets, exceed their liabilities. So the bank is still sound. The word used is solvent. However, they might be having a run on the bank. So what happens, the Federal Reserve will provide them with liquidity, will provide them with Federal Reserve notes, cash, if you will. So when I go in and ask for some money out of my checking account, they have the money. Because, see, if everyone that has a checking account goes to a bank and asks for their money, any bank is going to quickly run out of cash. Even with the reserves that they're supposed to have at the Federal Reserve, they're going to quickly run out. So what the Federal Reserve, as does other central banks, stands ready to provide as much liquidity as possible two banks that are still solvent. The problem you get into is sorting out which are the solvent banks that were managed prudently and which weren't, which are the risky banks. See, before the Federal Reserve was established, depositors really had to check out the banks. And we've had, for example, during the 1930s, over 10,000 banks failed. Now, I'm not going to get into that history. The United States has had a lot of banks, and one of the problems of the failures of these banks is government intervention, in this case on the state, insisting that you could only have one bank. You couldn't have branch banking. It might surprise you why over 10,000 banks failed in the United States, largely, not entirely, but largely because of these ridiculous rules. How many banks do you think failed in Canada? The answer is none, because they allowed branch banking. And why that's important is if you only have one bank in a locality, you can't branch out. You can't diversify your loan portfolio, nor can you diversify who your depositors are. So if an area, a city, a county, a state have economic problems, what invariably happens, the bank goes insolvent and has to be shut down, and we're shut down. So we've had changes in the law requiring, there are a number of big ones, not only reserve requirements, which we've always had, but they have fluctuated. As far as I'm concerned, should be much higher than they are, but that's another story that I'm not going to get into. We also had FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, that it gives the depositors some, how should I say this, warm feeling, comfortable feeling that they will get their money. So if the FDIC has to shut down a bank, it's going to make sure that the depositors are paid off. The problem you get into when you have these massive failures, when you're talking hundreds and in the 1930s, thousands of banks, and prior to the FDIC, you didn't have that. Now, there are pros and cons about having Federal Deposit Insurance, because one of the problems is every bank that has it, every bank has to pay for that. But you do, and what invariably happens is the well-managed banks, the ones that are prudent, manage their risk, invariably have to bail out or pay for those banks that took the risk and unfortunately didn't make out. They, for example, invested very heavily or were concentrated in mortgage-backed securities, and when those securities plummeted in value, the asset value plummeted. As a result, those banks went insolvent. So one primary mission of the Federal Reserve is to be a lender of last resort, and the Fed is that, as well as backstopping of the deposits of the people that have checking or savings accounts, the FDIC. That's one of their major functions. Their second major function, and very important function, is to have a stable currency. And the currency of the United States are dollars. They're federal notes. If you look in your wallet and pull out a dollar bill or a $20 bill, it'll say it's a Federal Reserve note. A note is an IOU. It says I owe you whatever it says, a dollar, $10 written on the Federal Reserve. Now, prior to 1914, the United States, as well as other countries, were on a gold standard where you could go into a bank and exchange your notes for gold. They were backed by gold. It was a commodity-backed currency, and the commodity was gold, and you could get a certain weight of gold depending on what the note value was. However, starting, the United States went off the gold standard in 1933, but what happened in 1914 was the start of World War I, and most of your large countries went off the gold standard. And the reason why is they had to pay for their, had to pay for the war, which meant they had to pay for armaments and munitions, everything you need for a war. And that included Germany, Russia, Austria, Serbia, France, United Kingdom, and eventually the United States as well. So when countries enter a war, they usually go off the gold standard. And what happens? They go into debt. They run massive deficits. part of the war is paid for by increased taxes. Part of the war is paid by borrowing money. And what happens is the governments run massive deficits where total outlays exceed total tax revenues. So you have, for example, war bonds being issued in the United States. They were in World War II. They were called Liberty Bonds. Anyway, wars are one of the reasons you have large debt. First, large deficits, where every year you're spending more money than you're collecting in taxes. And if a war lasts 2, 3, 4 years, what happens? Your deficits are going to be growing. And to pay your bills, you don't have enough tax revenues. You're going to have to issue debt. And why a large portion of that debt can be bought by financial institutions, such as commercial banks, insurance companies, investment companies, private investors, both domestically and abroad. If the government is trying to keep interest rates low or the cost of borrowing low, what will happen? Their central bank will also be buying a large percentage, not the entire issue, but a large percentage of those treasury securities. And you can understand when your country is threatened, whether it's the United States, United Kingdom, France, Germany, the patriotic thing, and people are for this, is to engage in this deficit financing with the understanding that once the war is over, that these debts will eventually, over time, be paid off. And that's exactly what happened in the United States in World War I and World War II, where we ran up the national debt right around 120% of total gross domestic product. That's the highest it's ever been so far. We will probably be breaking that percentage in the next couple of years. Now, yes, we've been in wars, and that's why I'm giving you this history. One, but not the entire story, is wars invariably result in deficit financing and large national debt. But most nations, including the United States and the United Kingdom, after the war, try to pay down that debt as quickly as possible. You see, what the federal government is doing in times of war is leveraging itself. It's going increasing into debt. And to enable that, the Federal Reserve has not been independent. It's helping the Treasury do that by keeping interest rates low, including the federal funds rate. And the federal funds rate is the overnight rate that banks pay to borrow money, because the banks have to meet certain reserve requirements depending on whether or not it's checking account money, checking account deposit money, or savings account. There's specific, I'm not going to get into the numbers on this. This is not an economic literature. I'm trying to relate this to what's happening in the news today, because I'm going to be getting onto the debt ceiling in a minute. But you need to understand the relationship between the central bank, and in the United States, that's the so-called Fed, or the Federal Reserve System, that acts as the United States bank. They don't issue the securities. The securities are the securities of the United States government, and they're auctioned off every business day by the Treasury Department. And there are usually three major categories. Actually, there are more than that, but the three major ones are Treasury bills, Treasury notes, and Treasury bonds. And people, they'll have an auction, and people will bid as to how much they will pay for those securities. And there's financial institutions. And this is a huge market. A matter of fact, in terms of, there are more Treasury securities out there than any other type of security that you can think of. It's a huge, huge, huge market. And there are a lot of people that are wanting to buy this, because if there ever is a war or a flight to safety, one of the places investors will be going is Treasury securities. There's a great demand for Treasury securities. However, if the Treasury securities are not paying an interest rate or yield that investors want, investors don't buy it, and who takes up the slack? And I'm not trying to confuse you here. I think a number of economists think that the buyer of first resort, not the lender of last resort, the buyer of last the buyer of first resort, they shouldn't be the first resort, of these Treasury securities has been the Federal Reserve. Now, what's happening right now is the Federal Reserve is cutting back, or so-called tapering, on the amount of Treasury securities as well as mortgage-backed securities that are issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And they've been buying in the past upwards of $85 million, roughly split half and half, not quite. Usually it's like $45 billion, I think, Treasury securities, $40 billion mortgage-backed securities. Now they're down to $65 billion, and they're going to gradually taper. And what many economists are predicting is that by the end of the year, or maybe by this time next year, that the Federal Reserve will not be engaging in printing more money. This is called the term you'll hear in the press as quantitative easing, or quantitative easing 3. Think of it as printing money, but they really don't print the money. They create the money. It's creating money and in turn credit by giving credit in a database. They sit at a keyboard and do a credit, and then that credit is issued to the Treasury, who in turn exchanges that for the U.S. Treasury security. And then what does the Treasury do? It spends that credit to pay its bills, and ultimately it gets back into the commercial bank system. So that, in a nutshell, is what's going on. Now, my problem is the federal government has been running massive deficits, starting with the Republicans and continuing, and Republicans under George Bush, both the first and second term, as well as President Obama. And the Democrats, when they were in control, they went nuts. I call it fiscal insanity. The two terms I use are the central problem in Washington, the core problem in Washington, D.C., is government spending is simply out of control. They're living way beyond the means of the American taxpayer to support this. Because when you're running deficits of over $1 trillion in 2009, 10, 11, 12, and in 13 it was $680 billion, and it looks like this year, fiscal year 2014, it'll probably be at least a half a trillion dollars. I think it's going to probably be somewhere between, the big range would be $600 billion up to a trillion. Because if a recession hits, what happens? People are laid off. When people are laid off, what happens to government revenues? It goes down. You're not collecting personal income taxes, you are collecting them, but you're collecting a lot less because people aren't working, businesses aren't making the money, so there's less corporate taxes. In addition, payroll taxes are down. And what that means is total tax collections of the federal government go down. So why right now it looks like, you know, based on just the first 4 months, you know, you can do the math, multiply $180 billion by 3, that would give you roughly $540 billion deficit. I think it's going to be higher than that, but we need additional information because it's very, very hard to estimate tax collections, because what really impacts tax collections or revenues, they call them revenues, is whether the economy is doing well or not. And the problem is we've had persistently high unemployment rates, above 6%, now going into the seventh year. See, near full employment, and you'll get a range of estimates from economists, my definition of near full employment is 3% or less. Many economists would say somewhere between 3 and 4% is near full employment. And there's an argument, has that near full employment number structurally gone up? Structurally is a nice way to say is, do we now have a higher permanent unemployment? I think if we had the correct monetary and fiscal policy, as well as a reduction in tax rates and regulations, you could have a significant increase in the growth rate of the economy. And when that happens, the unemployment rate would drop like a rock and could get back to 3% or even less. We've had unemployment rates of less than 3%. Not lately. certainly not lately, not in the last 12 years. Kind of the new normal is between 4 and 5%. But at one time, not anymore. If presidents got real scared, if they were in office and were going to be running for a second term, when unemployment rates got above 5 and 6%. For most of Obama's presidency, they have been above 8%. And a large percentage of that has been over 9%. It's only recently they've come down, and the major reason they've come down is the significant drop in the labor participation rate from its normal range of 66% to 67%. It's now down to 63%, which is a significant drop. What does that mean? There are a lot of people that have been looking for work that are now discouraged and are not participating in the labor force. They're not currently looking for a job. However, should the economy prosper and go into another boom phase, and it's going to happen. What's going to happen? All those people are going to rush back to the labor force. You see, what you need to be happening in terms of the unemployment rate, you want the unemployment rate to drop. I wish it was at 3%, and I wish the labor participation rate was at 67% or above. What I'm advocating are economic policies that the goal is to have unemployment at 3% or less, have labor participation rates of over 67%, and have inflation near zero or definitely under 1%, and a very broad definition of inflation less than 1%. Ideally, you would like stable prices. You don't necessarily have to have stable prices, but that should be the goal. And the Federal Reserve, as well as the federal government, has failed in really making this a robust recovery. We're not, for example, at the trend growth rate of the United States over many decades of a little over 3%. We're below that. And the only way you're going to get higher growth rates and in turn lower unemployment rates is to reduce the uncertainty created by the federal government as well as the Federal Reserve in Washington, D.C. People get nervous when they see the federal government year after year after year after year running these massive deficits. You don't need to be a genius to know that what people are saying is, well, how are they going to pay for these deficits? One, they're going to increase taxes, and they're doing it. They are doing it. They're increasing, well, let me be clear, they're increasing the tax rates. That doesn't mean they're going to increase the tax revenues. Yes, if you increase the tax rates, you might expect more tax revenues. It doesn't usually work out that way because people have a unique ability to avoid taxes, and they will. What has been found time and time again, if you lower the marginal tax rates, whether it's the income tax, capital gains rates, what invariably happens is tax revenues go up, and usually significantly. I'm not a fan of increasing the tax rates. What amazes me, the Democrats are not stupid, but they like to make this an issue. Well, we're increasing the tax rates on the rich. The goal should be, if you really want big government, is to increase the tax revenues to enable you to have that. I'm not in favor of big government, but if you want it, the smarter thing to do is to decrease the tax rates. They haven't really gotten that, or they've gotten it but want to ignore that. They rather say, well, we've really socked it to the rich. I'm waiting for Barack Obama, not now, but after the midterm elections, to propose another tax increase. Remember he said, I promise that if you're making $250,000 or less, I will not increase your taxes. Well, Obamacare is a big tax. The Supreme Court said it was a tax. That's now how it was sold to the American people. And if you want to challenge me on it, why don't you talk to your neighbors that have gotten their insurance canceled and have gone to the exchanges and found out they're paying 50%, 100%, 200% more in premiums. And then to add insult to injury, they're finding out that their deductibles are triple, quadrupled, or five times or more. That's a tax. That means I have less money to spend on other things. The American people are outraged. They're mad. The vast majority of the American people are against Obamacare. They were against it from the get-go. Supposedly, Obamacare was to reduce the number of uninsured. We're spending trillions of dollars to only reduce it by 10 million people. It's ridiculous. And why is it ridiculous? Because most Americans get their insurance through their employer. And most Americans were satisfied with that insurance. Does it mean everyone was satisfied? No. Some plans are going to be better than others. And I personally always favored individuals buying their own. I never really liked the idea that, for all practical purposes, if you work for a company of a fairly large company, let's put it that way, but many small companies had coverage, your health insurance was bought by your employer. In many instances, it was excellent coverage. I'm not complaining about the coverage, but everyone has different needs. I would much rather the employer give me the money and let me buy my own insurance. Now, the reason it didn't make sense is the employer has had since World War II, this is another case of government intervention, when they were controlling wages and prices again. That's always the problem. They interfere with the market system, where the most important part of that market system is prices being a discovery mechanism of what things are valued and how they're changing in value. Anyway, that's an aside, a digression I don't want to get into. But the history is that's when, starting in the war, that one way employers attracted, they needed labor because many of the men and some of the women were off to war. That solved the unemployment problem of the 30s, where the unemployment rate was consistently over 14%, and actually in 1933 got as high as 24.9%. Well, because over 10 million people ultimately were in the armed forces, what happened is more women participated in the labor force and were in the factories, as well as men. And to attract people to work in the factories, one of the benefits given was health insurance, group health insurance. And the reason I'm giving you this history, today most people, over 155 million, and I really think that number is low, but 155 million people or more are covered by their employer's group health insurance. And you have another anywhere from 15 to 25 million actually by individual coverage. Many of the other people are either covered by Medicare if they're over 65, or if they're poor, covered by Medicaid. But the bulk of the people that are working today get their health insurance through their employer. And what I was going to say yesterday is that President Obama, once again, is rewriting the law. And this is a very dangerous, dangerous practice. And he can make a legal case for it and may win in the courts. We'll see. But it's not the function of the executive branch to write the law. That is the function of the Congress, both the House of Representatives and the Senate. And it's very, very clear that this law was supposed to start on 1 January 2013. Now, what the president is doing is delaying the start for large, well, you have two groups. First, he delayed it many months ago. Last year, he delayed it for 1 year for all employers or that had 50 or more employees. Now he's gone a step further. If you fall if the number of employees you have are between 50 and 99, you have a 2 year. You have 2 years before you have to cover your employees. Now let me say this. In terms of number of plans and number of businesses, if the employer has 50 employees or less, he doesn't have to cover them. Many, and I would say even most companies, do cover it. That's been my experience. And usually if they don't cover it, it's because they can't afford it. It's not that they don't want to, because they got to attract and retain employees and they got to compete with other employers. And it's very, very simple. If I'm offered a job at the same salary, but one company offers me health insurance, well, that in terms of total compensation is better. And that's what I mean. It's not that employers, businesses, whoever the employer is, are mean people and don't want to provide health insurance to their employees. Most of them do. And the few that can't afford it. They're just not successful yet. They're usually new companies that have not been successful enough or have the cash flow to support it. I've worked for a few of those. And I've also sold health insurance to companies that at one time couldn't afford it, but a year later or two or three would say, okay, we have the money now, what do you have? Because I used to sell group health insurance mainly to small size, really small, two to nine people. And I don't want to go there, but the point I'm trying to make is most of the plans as well as businesses employ less than 50 people. And that's roughly, because the numbers are going to bounce around. It's about 95-96% in terms of the sheer numbers. The remaining 4% are those that have 50 or more, and it roughly breaks out. About half of those, about 2%, are between 50 and 99, and then those that are 100 or above are the other 2%. Of those, that 4%, most of those businesses have health insurance for their full-time employees. Some will also have it for part-times. Many don't. So what the president did is said, for those that are between 50 and 99, you have 2 years to make sure you have health insurance. And for those that are 100 or above, you have to cover at least 70% of your employees by 2015. Now, I'm not getting very excited at this. What I'm mad about is he shouldn't be changing the law like this. It's very, very clear. The law is clearly written. There's no ambiguity here. And what President Obama is doing is rewriting the law, and he shouldn't be. Listen, if he thinks there should be changes to the law, propose them and go to Congress. That is the appropriate legal way to do it, not act like a tyrant and unilaterally change the law. And that's what he's acting like. And this is, I'm not picking on one instance. Just this law, there have been 27 changes like this. And there are other laws he's done the same thing, including drugs and immigration. He is out of control and needs to be reined in. Now, the problem is he's not running for re-election. And I know there's some people say, well, he's going to run for a third term. No, he's not. Because if he did, there would be a revolution. And they would be after his head. He's not going to do that. He might try, but I seriously doubt it. I think he wants to go play golf. This is a very demanding job. And I don't think, I don't take these suspicions serious at all. I think the Democratic Party is going to run either Hillary Clinton if she runs, and I'm still on the fence on this, or somebody else. It could be Jerry Brown. I'm just throwing out a name. I don't really care. I'm not going to vote for any Democrat because all they want to do is grow and grow and grow the size of the government. They have no sense of urgency or no real sense of the dangerous situation we're in. You see, there are two ways you're going to hear, well, we have to increase the national debt ceiling so we don't default on the debt. The United States is never going to default in the debt in the sense of not paying principal interest when it's due. No, that's not the way it's done, ladies and gentlemen. Maybe Greece would do that or Argentina would do that. But large countries, especially the United States, they're not going to do that. What they're going to do is default in this sense. They're running up inflation, and it's coming back just like the 70s. It's going to come roaring back, and it's going to catch the Federal Reserve sleep at a switch again. I like to, you know, inflation just runs up and just grabs you. And before you know it, prices, the general price level, remember Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz's quote, and I generally paraphrasing, inflation is always a monetary phenomenon. In other words, it's the Federal Reserve or the central bank that is expanding, both massively expanding both money and credit. Now, up to now, prices have been fairly stable. I'm not denying that if you just confine yourself to consumer prices and a subset of that. But that's just one form of inflation to look at. What's happened in asset prices, especially stocks? What happened in the early part of this century in real estate? We had they're called asset bubbles. And assets are broken down into certain asset categories, such as real estate. The major categories are real estate, stock, bonds, and there's subcategories under each one of these. You could have government bonds, you could have corporate bonds, And you could have domestic bonds and foreign bonds. There are a lot of categories. But the major asset categories are real estate, stocks or equities, bonds, gold or precious metals, commodities. What you're seeing, and you saw yesterday, is a run-up in the Dow Jones and S&P 500. And the reason you did is because Janet Yellen, the new Federal Reserve chairman, made it very, very clear that she is going to continue the policies of Ben Bernanke. Now, Ben Bernanke had a nickname, Bubbles. And the reason he got the name was that, or Helicopter Ben, and that's probably the more common one, that he would, to reinflate the economy, and that's what the Federal Reserve is doing, he would drop money out of helicopters, and people would scurry for the money and then buy and then spend it. Well, 2 points, and I said this in my last show. Amongst economists, you have one group that are for rule-based monetary policy, and I'm in that camp or school, however you want to characterize that. And you also have those that are for discretion. We are, for all practical purposes, following a discretionary, big-time discretionary policy. But to cut through all the jargon and what's going on, what is the Federal Reserve in essence doing and has been doing? It's financing the federal government. Don't fall for the nonsense. It's independent. It's not. It's not independent. Because what should have happened in Congress? Two things. They should have been cutting spending with the goal of balancing the budget. Are we anywhere near that? No. A balanced budget means total spending outlays equal total tax revenues. Last year, we had a deficit. In other words, outlays exceeded revenues by $680 billion. And we're on track for another $500 billion or $500 billion or more deficit this year. Now, be the first to say, I like the trend line, because for 4 years, we're over $1 trillion. But that was unprecedented of itself. All of these deficits, when President Obama was president and still is, and especially his first 4 years when the Congress was controlled by the Democrats and ran up over, if you add up those 4 years, over $5 trillion of deficits. That translates in more debt being required to pay the bills. Because basically, when you're spending more than the revenue, your income and taxes are coming in, you got to find the money somewhere. And what the Federal Reserve, what the U.S. Treasury does is borrow the money, massively borrow the money at manipulated, controlled, suppressed, low, very low interest rates. What's going to happen is once inflation comes back, we already have inflation in asset prices, certain asset classes. And that's the word I was looking for, asset classes. Those were the major asset class categories. And some investment managers as well as would have others. I'm not going to get into that detail. I've given you the big three, real estate, stocks, and bonds. And another one would be commodities, including gold. Anyway, we are right now inflating another asset bubble, just like we did in the early 2000s up to 2006 and 7, where the bubble or the speculation was in real estate. Now it's in U.S. equities. Now there are two things that the Fed is trying to avoid. One is inflation. And you heard her testimony yesterday. We're well below the 2% targets that the Federal Reserve has set. They're running around 1%. So we're not very concerned about inflation. The other big concern, think of it as two monsters surrounding the Fed. One is inflation, the inflationary monster. And the other big monster is deflation, where you have a general decrease in prices. That's the one that they really are scared about. That's where you have falling prices. If that gets out of control, you can have a depression. I will agree. You need to be concerned about both. That's why the primary mission of the Federal Reserve or any central bank is to try to run it right down the middle. In other words, avoid inflation and avoid deflation by having very, very stable prices. The problem is the Federal Reserve track record in this regard is abysmal. It's checkered. At best, you can say it's checkered. It's really horrible. They make mistakes all the time. These are human beings. And what it's a group of human beings, very smart, very good intention, well-meaning, good intentioned. They're trying to do their best to avoid both inflation and deflation. But there are limits as to the knowledge, and I would say, more importantly, not only knowledge, the wisdom as to know what to do. You really have a small group of very smart people backed by very smart staff. Most of them have PhDs in economics from your finest schools. Are you impressed? Well, be impressed. But what has happened in the last 100 years? What has happened to the purchasing power of the dollar? That would be Exhibit A. On Exhibit A, namely the value has declined to less than three cents. I would say it's time to end the Fed. I think you've heard that once. Ron Paul, when he was running, said, end the Fed. And guess what? Some of the young people were catching on. Most of them probably were taking economics and could understand this. Because the problem is, where you don't have stable prices, what does that mean? The value of your money, what the economists call purchasing power, the value of your money is going down, down, and down. It's gradual, though, so you almost don't notice it. But most people are noticing. Why are they noticing it? Just like what happened to me Sunday. Gasoline prices, when I was coming home, going to Richland College, were $2.95 at a gas station, a racetrack. I had already passed the station, but I made a note of my mind, when I come back, I need to buy some gasoline. And by then, instead of being $2.99 or $3 a gallon, it was $3.16. I'm rounding up. You know, they play the 99 thing. 16 cents. So if I needed a full tank, that's $1.60. That's a big jump. But gas prices have been highly volatile. And I will agree to the Fed. Gas price. Why are gas prices volatile? You need to look no further. There are two things to look at. The Federal Reserve, with its easy monetary policy of 25 basis points, or 0.25% on the federal funds rate, that they've had going on over 5 years. That's absurd. That's laughable. Because that causes major distortions. One of the distortions it causes is speculation in certain investment classes, including commodities, in this case, petroleum. And you've had massive speculation in future contracts of petroleum. That's what's driving up the volatility of the. Do you think the gas station is determining these prices? No. It's the futures prices of petroleum or oil. Now, part of the problem is the easy monetary of the Federal Reserve. The other part is we've had deregulation of the futures market, where at one time, speculators, and they're the ones responsible for this, could only write about 30% of the contracts. The rest had to be written by people that either produced or used petroleum. That has gone by the boards, and today it's more than the reverse. 70-80% or more are written by so-called speculators that never take delivery of this petroleum. And you and every American are paying the price. And why do they get away with it? It's simple. These financial institutions make major contributions to both political parties, so they're setting the rules and screwing you. And they know they can get away with it because most people don't understand future contracts. I'm not even going to try to explain them to you. Other than they're the combined the easy monetary of the Federal Reserve, which means the cost of using leverage or debt to the speculators very low, when you combine it with the returns on that leverage, they're going to speculate in commodities, including oil. Now, yes, sometimes they win, sometimes they lose, but it's like a gambling casino. They're betting on the future price of a barrel of petroleum. And it depends what type and where it's from. Not going to go there. But why am I mentioning that? That affects you every week. Not every day, but every week, most people have to buy gasoline for their car. And they're paying more than they really should. If you truly did not have this easy monetary policy, and there are things the Federal Reserve could do. They could increase the margin requirements for these contracts. That's one easy thing. They're not going to do that because there's a lot of pressure brought to bear on this. And they could change, they could go back to the regulating what they should. See, I'm usually not for regulation, but there are cases where the general welfare requires regulation. In this case, they do. And it's really hurting Americans in terms of the cost of their fuel. And don't think because of all the oil and natural gas that is being found that you're suddenly going to see a decline in gasoline prices. No, because most of that is going to be exported abroad. And that's what you got to keep in mind. This is an international market. Don't try to blame the corporations such as Exxon that are based in I think they're in Plano, but they're based in Dallas. They're price takers. What's driving the price of petroleum is the speculation in the futures market. And what is enabling that is the low cost of borrowing as a direct result of the Federal Reserve keeping the federal funds rate arbitrarily at a very low rate. That is what causes asset bubbles. That is what causes speculation. And that is what is driving up prices. And it's only a matter of time when you're going to see the prices of your consumer goods going up. Because what I've seen is my energy and electrical and food prices are going up. And I don't care who you are, but you got to eat. You got to drive your car, and you probably want electricity to light your house. Use your refrigerator for cooking and heating in the winter and air conditioning in the summer. All of that is driven, the cost of doing business is driven by excessive speculation in these commodities. Well, enough said. What I'm trying to zero in on is the national debt ceiling. It is definitely going to go up, and it will be extended until March of next year. And I think it will be increased to probably just under $19 trillion. Let's just eyeball it. We're currently at slightly below $16.4 trillion in gross national debt. So 12 months from now, we'll be definitely over $18 trillion. So they're going to and they usually play this out. It definitely will take us beyond the election. That's what the Democrats want, and really that's what the Republicans want. They want to get this issue off the table. Okay, fine with me. Actually, it's not fine with me because I want them to balance the budget in 4 years. Did you vote for the Republicans in 2010 thinking that maybe 4 years they'd balance the budget or at least be a long way closer to it? Well, many did, and yeah, I know the Senate's still controlled by the Democrats, and President Obama's a Democrat, but I thought by now we'd be a lot closer to a balanced budget. We're not. When I mean closer, definitely under half a trillion. I was hoping we'd get it somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 or $400 billion, which is not good. That's terrible, but in 4 years, that's what I was hoping the Republicans would accomplish. They obviously have not done that, and a large reason for that, we have, and I call them the bigs, big interventionist government status. They're Republicans that are those, and they're also most of the Democrats. I would say all the Democrats are those. They want bigger government. You have big government conservatives. And I know for a strong national defense, you're going to have to, that requires money. The problem is, look at the reason I went in the previous shows over the welfare programs. If you add all those up, welfare programs are over $500 billion. Over half a trillion. With approximately half of that being Medicaid. And then when you look in entitlements, we got a big problem there. You see, the hard decisions, or what's called the heavy lifting, has not happened. We have, there's various terms for this, gridlock or deadlock government. Yeah, we do. And the problem is, we don't have much time to get our fiscal house in order. The earliest I think we're even going to make any significant progress on this is 2016. In other words, we've wasted 6 years. We had 6 years to get our house in order. Obama's had five, and he's made it worse, a lot worse. You can't keep blaming Bush. Bush has been out of office for 5 years. And we've had a major stimulus package of over $800 billion. We have Obamacare that's adding several hundred billions each year to the deficit and the debt. And they want to grow the government. They don't want to balance the budget. They want it bigger. And to the extent they're fiscally responsible at all they want to really do is increase taxes. And you can't keep taxing the rich. There's just not enough of them. That means taxing the middle class. Who do you think is paying for these subsidies? It's the middle class. It's not right. It's like going to your neighbor and with a gun knocking on the door and say, listen, I'm short money for my health insurance. Give me the money so I can pay it. Well, that's robbery if an individual does it. When the government does it, it's called a mandate. And see, what's aggravating, and I think the Democratic Party has made a major miscalculation, the overwhelming majority of people, Democrats and Republicans, liberals, conservatives, whatever their political philosophy, whatever their party affiliation, and the majority party affiliation today is independents, may I remind both political parties, because people are getting sick of both parties. They're sick of this shucking and jiving nonsense, this BSing, lying to the American people. They've had it with both parties because they know they're being lied to. They know the federal government is living way beyond their own ability to support this large government. And all they're asking for is, it's not very hard to understand, live within the means of the American people. In other words, balance the budget. Instead, year after year after year, it's usually every 12 to 15 months, what do? We have this exercise of increasing the debt ceiling. That's just admitting that we're running these massive deficits that requires more debt. That's why we have to raise the debt ceiling. We need more debt to pay the bills. And that's admitting you've run these massive deficits. And the American people have had it up to here. They want it stopped. Stopped. Every individual, family, business, college, school, city, county, state has to balance the budget. It is more than past time for the federal government to do the exact same thing. So I hope the ruling elite are having a party tonight and over the weekend to celebrate the increase of the debt ceiling. The American people are outraged. They're calling talk shows. They're disgusted with House Majority, House Speaker John Boehner and the Republicans. My disgust is in the fact that we haven't even made nearly no progress in heading to, yeah, we're going in more or less the right direction. But have there been major real cuts in spending? No, there have not been. The only reason why the deficit is going down is the fact that they are collecting more revenue as a direct result of higher taxes. That's what's going on. So, yeah, you know, Boehner had the rule for every dollar increase in the national debt, we want a dollar cut in spending. Well, we don't have that anymore. That was nullified. Boehner's really Mr. Unconditional Surrender in terms of the Democratic Party. As far as I'm concerned, they should scrap the entire leadership of the Republican Party. Now, I know I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. I'm clearly now for a third party. I'm really sick and tired of people that have served in the Republican Party as secretary or in some capacity. They're true believers and they're loyalists to the Republican Party. The Democrats have the same thing. But today, 40% of the Americans are independents. They don't care what the Republican Party is doing, nor the Democratic Party. And it's only a matter of time when that number hits 50% that you're going to have another third party, and that I will support if it is a principled party that truly believes in the Constitution, truly believes in the rule of law. None of this president dictates and changing the law unilaterally. That is tyranny, folks. That is tyranny. That's what Hitler did. That is what Stalin did. That is what Mao did. And some Americans are watching it, know it's dangerous, and know it needs to be stopped in its track. And where is Congress? It's unilaterally surrendering and increasing the debt ceiling. What they should have been doing is balancing the budget earlier over the last 4 years. Where were they? At least propose it and vote on it. They haven't done it. That's my fear. Let's say the Republicans win, and the predictions are they will win, maintain the House and win and probably get control of the Senate. Are they going to balance the budget then? I don't think so. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Opinions on this show and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. Thank you for listening. I will probably have an update because the Senate will probably have voted tonight on this if they haven't already. So I'll tell you exactly how long the debt limit will be extended and how much money that translates into. Thank you for listening, and back to the music.